Welcome to Hundreds of Ways, the podcast that celebrates entrepreneurship and lifestyle independence. This week, Tom Critchlow shares how he grew from SEO consultant to independent strategy partner, and how thinking in public through writing has shaped his career. So join us as we explore which of the Hundreds of Ways belongs to Tom.
Hey, James. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Elliot. This is the first time I get to say that to you since you are now on this side of the Atlantic.
I know. How exciting. Makes things quite a bit easier for us coordinating and whatnot. But great to be here.
Today, we have another fantastic guest, one that I'm very personally excited to have on. Tom Critchlow, welcome to the podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys.
I've been a very longtime fan of Tom's writing. Later in the episode, we're going to talk in depth about some of his previous newsletters, as well as the new project that he's working on, Little Futures. But writing is just one of the things that Tom does. So to start off, Tom, do you mind telling our listeners a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, sure. So right now, my primary kind of identity and work is around being an independent strategy consultant. I spend a lot of time both doing client work, but also thinking about how to be an independent strategy consultant and have a community for independent strategy consultants. And I do writing about independent strategy consultants and say the word independent strategy consultants far too many times. In addition to that, I'm a dad. I've got two kids, one 4.5 and one about 8 months old. So that's, you know, takes up a lot of time and energy and headspace. I have an art business that I run with my partner called Fiercely Curious, which I think has been a little bit on the back burner in recent times since we've had the kids and so on. But that's a nice creative outlet. And then, yeah, I have this new project, Little Future, which is a new email list that I'm working on. That about sums it up, I guess.
So when you say independent strategy consultant, could you go into a little bit more depth on the types of clients that you work with and the types of projects that you work on with them?
I kind of got my start working in digital in the SEO industry. I work in the UK. I work with my brother at an agency called Distilled. And this is back in like 2008, 2009. The SEO industry is really interesting because it's a small industry, but it's also like full of generalists. Like SEO as a discipline is lots of different things and has certainly evolved over time. And so it was a really good kind of place to start my career as a mixture of consulting, content creation, technical analysis, and just general kind of like web foolery. And so that was kind of where I started my career. I spent a couple of years at Google, and then after doing all of that, went out on my own about almost 6 years ago now. And the work that I've done, you know, it varies a lot, but it's usually a mixture of digital strategy, organizational design, and executive coaching for companies that are in the content industry. And the content industry is everything from established media companies like the New York Times, all the way over to maybe companies on the B2B side or the enterprise side, people like Gartner that you might not think of as a content company, but actually produce almost as much content as the New York Times does, as well as the growing trend of direct-to-consumer e-commerce companies, where it's almost a joke now that every company needs to be in content and commerce. And so, you know, every company is a content company, I think, is not really an exaggeration these days, but it's usually my background in content that it brings legitimacy to my client work. And then the actual work that I do is really wide-ranging and varied, everything from, you know, product innovation, strategy, team building, organizational design, all kinds of things.
A lot of what you just described to me sounds like kind of one of the holy grails of freelancing and consulting, which is where you get to move into this very broad, very strategy-oriented role. So I think it's super interesting that you also brought up that you kind of started off doing more of the SEO thing, which is more of an operations and very process-heavy. How did you transition from doing kind of more, I'll say, rote work to this being this kind of strategy partner that you are now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in particular, I think when I left Google, so I spent 2 years working at Google and worked on all kinds of weird and wonderful projects like future vision roadmaps and product innovation and these things that are like very disconnected from either strategy or reality. And I had these grand visions when I started out on my own that I was going to do, you know, product innovation and R&D strategy work for clients. And very quickly realized that nobody really knew that I could do those things, or I didn't really have any credibility around those things. And that what people knew me for was my SEO work. And so actually, when I first started going out on my own, I did a lot of what I considered quite kind of menial or straightforward work, you know, SEO audits and SEO strategies and things. And initially, that was kind of demoralizing. It felt like a step backwards from what I'd been doing previously, and it didn't feel as senior work as I was used to doing. But I was able to kind of gradually over time transition that work into more senior work, more strategic work. And in my mind, I have this kind of framing, which is I think strategic work and strategy work in general is nothing more than work in context. It is the ability to look at a project and look at a set of challenges in context of the wider business, whatever that may be. And so most of what that means is just getting access to the executive layer, oftentimes the C-suite of the business, to be able to say, okay, well, we're doing this content strategy over here, or we're launching this new business unit over here, but what else are we doing, right? What is this in context of elsewhere in the business, both in terms of our business model, our brand, our people, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think strategy is a nice sounding word, and I certainly use it a lot in my writing, probably too much, but it's kind of a lazy shorthand, I think, oftentimes for, like I said, just doing work in context. And so when I think about my work, I think, okay, I actually don't mind doing any kind of menial or more process operations focused work, so long as I'm working with the senior executive team and so long as it is in the context of everything else the organization is doing. And so that's kind of how I think about strategy work. And yes, sometimes I'll work on what might be more familiar strategy work, like an actual kind of go-to-market plan or a kind of a mergers and acquisitions type thing where you're spending all day long in presentations and presenting up to the board or C-suite, and all of that is well and good. And that work can often be kind of fun, but that work is also often quite short-lived relative to the like ongoing nature of operations and processes and team building and organizational design. So a lot of my work spans both the strategy side and what I call it as kind of stewardship work. You can think about it as kind of execution, strategy and stewardship. This notion of kind of helping the client know what to do and then actually helping them operationalize it.
So if I can hop in here for a second, it sounds like that transition of your starting out in the world of SEO to where you got to today took quite some time. I mean, it wasn't something that happened overnight. And I think what a lot of people think about when they transition into working for themselves or freelancing or whatever it might be, anything that separates them from that traditional role, oftentimes when you're in the corporate space, you realize something's going to take 5-10 years to progress. But then you get out on your own and you think, oh, this is going to happen overnight. Obviously, that wasn't the case for you, as it rarely is for anybody. But what was that kind of feeling like? As you were saying, there was that time when it was a little bit demoralizing to not have access to some of those projects you wanted to be working on. What kept you going through that to get into the next stage?
There are kind of two ways to answer that, I think. One is I quickly realized being out on my own that the thing that nobody tells you when you go out on your own is that you have to manage your own identity, your own notion of who you are. And there is also no external sense of career progression, right? There's no job titles, there's no promotions, there's not even a year-end review, unless you look in the mirror. And so I quickly realized that growth and evolution as an independent is a thing which happens in a much more compounding and iterative sense. Whereas inside the corporate world or inside like the more established systems, it happens in a much more discrete way, right? Like you can leave a job and get a new job, and that comes with a new job title, a new salary and new seniority and so on. But that happens in kind of discrete jumps. Whereas an independent, it's much more of a gradual progression and a constantly evolving process. And so when I realized that, that was really helpful for me to say, okay, so every new client I get, it has to be a move in the right direction. There has to be a kind of compounding effect or a compound growth that goes into that. That all sounds very well put together in hindsight. At the time, obviously, it's also terrifying because you're like, where is the next client going to come from? Is the next client going to be better than the last one or the same as the last one? And it's a constant kind of game of shadow boxing against what you're kind of pretending to be in each new client call, right? Every time a client comes to you and you say, I do these things, and it's like 80% truth and 20% lies, or 20% aspiration, I should say. And so it's a constant kind of game of stretching your identity, stretching your expertise without lying, without being disingenuous, without betraying the client's trust, and without landing yourself in a situation where you can't deliver and you can't do the work and you're over your head. And so that's a pretty stressful game to play. And I think it took me a while to kind of come to terms with it and navigate my way through it. But that's certainly a journey that I went on. But there is another way to answer that question, which actually I think is really interesting. And again, I've only realized this in hindsight, but when I first left Google or when I went out on my own, the story that I told was actually not, I'm going to go be an independent strategy consultant or I'm going to be a freelance marketing consultant. It was really neither of those things. The story that I told was, hey, I just launched this art collective with my partner, and we're going to try and turn that into a real business. And what's amazing about that in hindsight, even though the art business, you know, really became more like a project than a real business, is it gave me this kind of narrative air cover to be able to introduce myself at parties or talk about what I'm doing or just have an internal compass that says, oh, well, what I'm doing is I'm building this art collective, and it's really creative, and it's really interesting, and it's like really exciting, and I get to, you know, pretend like I'm an entrepreneur and building a business. And yet at the same time, I was paying the bills by doing the consulting work. And it was only in hindsight that I realized how important that narrative air cover and that kind of narrative institution is that you can point to? Because in the first, I'd say like 12, 18 months of doing consulting work, clients come and go. It's very spiky. You have almost no data points to go on. You don't really know what you're doing. You're struggling with both paying the bills and this sense of identity. And so in hindsight, it was super useful for me to have that project, that label and that thing to be able to point to say, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm attaching my identity to. And that kind of gave me, I guess, peace of mind to be able to go and like figure it out on the consulting side.
I love how you call it narrative air cover. I think that's such a fun way to describe it. I think a lot of people look out at people that they admire, people who are doing interesting work like you, and they think, oh, this person, you know, Tom woke up one day and was suddenly no longer doing boring things anymore. All of a sudden, Tom was an interesting person doing interesting work. But like you've just described, that's a process. And sometimes starting the interesting things, even if they're more of an art project than a business, can give you the both external, like you said, narrative air cover, and also the internal kind of self-image cover. It helps when you go talk to people because you're doing interesting things, but it also helps you when you're motivating yourself through, like Elliot brought up earlier, these tough times to keep yourself moving forward.
Yeah, totally. I don't know how useful this advice is in a certain sense, because you have to actually believe the narrative air cover yourself, right? So it's an interesting exercise to kind of understand how much you can manufacture that. But I do think that it points to a deeper idea about the overall value of kind of side projects and launching ideas, and that not everything has to be a business, right, to be useful right to you. And I think that has been really important to me around removing that anxiety, like especially in living in New York and having a lot of friends in the tech industry. And a lot of my friends are like starting startups and raising VC money. And there's a lot of that, oh, should I be doing that? Should I try and do that game? And you realize actually like there's a ton of value in doing side projects that aren't businesses. And that can be creative ventures or can be narrative air cover. And so I think it's good to kind of remind yourself that there's a more nuanced perspective to all these things than just having to quote unquote launch a startup.
Yeah, if you want to be more interesting, just start doing more interesting things. You know, I want to go back to one thing you brought up in the first half of your answer because I loved it so much. So Tom and I were actually at Google New York together. We were talking in the green room before this a little bit about how that doesn't really mean anything because with probably now there's probably like 8,000 people in that office. But even back when we were both there in 2013, there's some 5,000 people there. So Tom and I might have never actually been in the same room together, even though we work together. But one of the things you just brought up that I think is super funny is this idea of when you're an independent, whether it's freelancer or entrepreneur, agency owner, there's no year-end review. And something that's come up with some other guests too is these kind of these things about corporate life that when you're in the corporate life, you hate. Nobody at Google likes PERF is what it's called. Right. Nobody at Google is excited for PERF. So to hear Tom say afterwards, you know, something that's kind of missing from his life is this corporate year-end review process. It's interesting because there are things that seem like negative limitations when you're in these jobs that maybe when you're now missing them, you realize that, hey, it's actually super nice that once a year, your direct superior and a handful of other people at the company that you work at sit down with you and go, hey, here's what you did well. Here's what you didn't do well. Here's what you should do to improve. Comparing that now to what Tom does now, which is basically it's up to him to decide every time he takes a client, if it's an improvement, every time he finishes a project, he's going to get feedback from the client, but it's just not the same. Even as partners, they're going to be on different teams when it comes to that moment. And so it's super interesting to hear another example of something that, again, when you're in the corporate life, no one likes their year-end review, but when you're out of it, it might actually be something that you miss.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know as I would go as far to say I miss the corporate year-end review. And actually, I think in many ways, it's about being able to do a process of self-reflection and self-analysis that is ongoing and evolving and integrates with your actual ambitions, right? Like, I think a lot of people struggle with things like year-end reviews because it is so structural against what reality is today instead of what your ambitions are for tomorrow. And I think that when you think about self-reflection and you think about personal identity and personal growth, so much of it is about who you want to be tomorrow, who you want to grow into. And yet so much of PERF, as you mentioned, like year-end review in the corporate world, is just about, well, what did you do this year and how good was it? And that's such a tiny sliver of what a kind of true reflective self-integration with a notion of personal growth looks like. Like if you go to a therapist, yes, they want a good idea of what reality looks like, but like you spend a lot of time thinking about who you want to be and how you can make that happen, how you can change your behaviors, not just like, did you do a good job in that conversation you had yesterday or not? Like, you know, all of that is to say that, yeah, I don't miss Perf.
I love how you mentioned also there was a line there about saying when you're talking to a client, you started out by saying it's lies and then you backtrack for a moment and said aspirational, because that's really what it is. You don't have a higher up telling you what the path is or where it is that you're going. You're having to build that path for yourself. And on that same note, when you're not having that feedback, you have to decide whether or not you're moving in the right direction or if need a pivot or whatever it might be. But I just loved how you kind of contextualize that there. It's aspirational. It's not a lie. A great way to put it.
Yeah. And I think it's also a good reminder of just how much, especially having worked at an agency and then having worked at a big company, there is a lot of practices in the world of business that are designed to be legible, right? They're designed to be, we need to create a name for this project, or we need to create a name for what this kind of work is so that we can make it a line item in a spreadsheet and we can report on it and so on and so forth. And this is true for any kind of small operation, but in particular for independents, there is always this disconnect between the words that people use and the actual meaning underneath them. And so even if a client comes to you and says, we need help with our digital marketing strategy, there is always a process of going one level deeper to try and understand. It's like, okay, well, why do you need help with this? Like, what have you tried previously? Like, why did the CMO that you hired last year not work out? You know, why did the CEO think marketing is important? There's all this kind of like shadow work underneath, in between the like formal definitions and labels that people use around the work. And so to come back to that point around 80% truth and 20% lies/aspiration, it's like, well, actually, the 80% truth is also just made up, right? Like, there was a big disconnect between somebody who claims to know how to do brand strategy and what this particular client's needs around brand strategy are, right? There is always a disconnect between those things. And to pretend that just because you're using the same words, you mean the same thing is itself a lie. And so I think I work really hard in my work to try and push to a deeper level of understanding and a deeper level of like the systems at work inside a client's organizations, the people involved, their motivations, their biases, to really try and understand what does it mean to be effective in this context, in this work, for this client at this moment.
This sort of what you described as shadow work is so important when you're on your own, because unlike when you're at a company, you have no cover. So if you're working at a company and your superior or a client says, I want, you know, XYZ done, and you go do XYZ, and they really meant they wanted ABC done. They wanted something else entirely. They were thinking about the wrong thing. They were using the wrong language. And Tom is not under describing this. This is something that happens a ton with clients, is they say they want X and they really have no idea what they want. But when you work at a company, if you do X and you show the email trail that your manager told you to do X, you're going to be fine. Now you get to do the other thing. No one's going to get you in trouble. But when your job is to get results for your clients and they're asking you to do one thing and they mean another thing, that's on you. And so this sort of shadow work that Tom describes is, gosh, I'd almost argue it's the reason why you hire a consultant and not just someone to just do rote work. It's a hugely important part of this process.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's obviously pros and cons to consultants and so on. I'm obviously going to be biased in that answer, but yeah, I think it's an interesting distinction for sure.
So Tom, we talked a bit about that transition period, how you navigated that beginning shift away from Google into that kind of independent identity. And we talked about how Fiercely Curious, the art collective, gave you that kind of narrative air cover to progress from those initial steps as an independent entrepreneur to where you are now. But what I'd love to talk about now is more detail on that transition, because since starting out, you've worked with some pretty big name clients, people like the New York Times, people like Etsy, I mean, folks that are household names, definitely big deal clients. How did you move from that initial, like you said, kind of more SEO, more process heavy, to nailing clients like the New York Times?
Yeah, I mean, it's a gradual evolution. I think there is a set of things that have been really beneficial for me. Firstly, I had a very strong network from my days in the SEO industry. I used to speak at conferences and I used to do a lot of blogging, and I had a fairly large kind of audience or set of people that knew me. And so my kind of extended network was pretty strong. And that's where I get, I would say, pretty much all of my business from, is through my network. And so that was a big advantage that I had. And then the second thing, I think, in this kind of ongoing process that I've taken since I've been independent, is thinking in public and writing online has been a kind of superpower in terms of deliberately doing two things. One is increasing my network and increasing my visibility by being constantly present online. But secondly, and perhaps less obviously, having a big network is only one piece of the puzzle. The other piece of the puzzle is that the people that are in your network need to have a clear enough understanding of how you think and the work that you do so that they can make a good referral, right? And so when I first started out on my own, my network only knew me for my SEO work. And so those are the referrals they make. They say, oh, hey, I have a friend at the New York Times. They need some SEO strategy. Tom, you should go speak to them. And that's great. Like, I'll take that intro. And that's kind of somebody to make that. And it's great for that to happen. But what I really want to happen is for somebody to be like, oh, I have this friend in the New York Times R&D department that's struggling with product innovation. You should go speak to Tom because that's what he does. But that transition for that context, for that intro to be made in the network requires that you are building a mental model or a mental image for folks in your network of what it is you do and how you do it. And so for me, that all came to my writing. Like all of my writing and blogging and kind of being public has been in service of basically helping my network uncover like, oh, he's thinking about these things. Oh, he thinks about those things. Oh, he's done this kind of work. That's really interesting. And obviously not all of my writing is about that, but it kind of comes through in the cracks. And so I think that's been a really important thing for me to understand, which is that your network is an asset that you have and it is incredibly valuable to you as an independent, but you also need to make sure that you're educating your network or creating that visibility in the right way. Otherwise, you're going to keep getting leads for the kind of thing that they know that you can do, even if that is from work, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago.
To reiterate on this, I'm not nearly as prolific as Tom. We'll talk more about your writing in a second, but you have hundreds and hundreds of posts on your site. And like you said, you've given talks and all that. I have done a couple of podcasts as a guest. We've done this show now for a couple months, and I've written a few things out there. But even with just the little bit I have out there, on a weekly basis, I get someone who comes and goes, hey, I really liked what you said about XYZ. Can we talk more about it? And some of this stuff is something I said 2 years ago on a podcast that I totally forgot I guested on. But it is crazy how powerful having your voice out there, both figuratively through writing and literally if you're recording talks or going on podcasts, it allows people to get to know you, to build, like Tom said, this mental model of who you are, what you do, and how you think. And then when it comes time, when they're reminded of something they need that happens to be something you've talked about or something you do, it's almost like, oh yeah, my good buddy Tom does this because I've read all his stuff about it. And that power is enormous.
Yeah, totally. I want to really focus on a word that you use there, voice. I think that it is incredibly important, if not the entire game of kind of generating work from your network, is to be distinctive and to have personality and opinion. And I think it is a big mistake that people make thinking that they have to write content, produce content where they have it all figured out. They have the answers. They're like, here's how to do X, or here is the solution to Y. And in the process of trying to kind of professionalize their content, they remove their voice, they remove their personality and their like distinctive kind of tone and their style. And in fact, it is voice, it is personality, opinion, and style and ways of thinking, which gets you clients, right? Clients are attracted not to people that have the answer, but to people that think like them. And this is increasingly true at the executive layer, right? Executives don't go hunting for somebody who has the answer. They go hunting for somebody who can think like them. And so you're absolutely right that, I mean, podcasts and conferences in particular are a really great example of this, where your voice, your literal voice, like shines through, right? Your personality comes through. And so I really try and do that in my writing too. I try and create a distinctive voice and a distinctive style and so on in my writing just by being myself. And I really try not to do the bad solution-focused content. This is like 1,000% true in the SEO industry in particular of like, here's how to do keyword research for an e-commerce brand. And it's dry, it's trying to be solution focused, it's trying to have all the answers, and it doesn't open up any space for inquiry, it doesn't open up any style, it doesn't have any opinion, it doesn't have any voice in it. And I would much rather write content about the questions that I have than the answers that I have. And by exploring questions that are alive for me right now, I'm going to find clients and executives who are like, that is the same question I'm thinking about right now. This person must be a good fit to come help me solve these things. I think the concept is just really, really key.
So this is a perfect segue into your most recent project that you're currently relaunching, Little Futures, because if any piece of writing I've ever read has a strong voice, it's that. Little Futures, for anyone that's not familiar, I'll let Tom describe it in depth, but it's a newsletter that Tom's been putting out. And the topics combine philosophy, psychology, and business in a way that is just, even if an issue doesn't pertain to you, it's interesting and it's so well done. So Tom, let's talk Little Futures. Can you give a little background on the project?
Yeah, and thanks for the kind words. Yeah, so Little Futures is actually a collaboration, me and my friend Brian Dell. And both of us have kind of fallen into brand strategy, digital strategy, and both of us have a healthy interest in the humans behind the business organizations at work. And so organizational psychology, actual psychology, philosophy, and so on are all kind of things that we draw on in our work. And Little Futures in particular, it started as a very specific response to what we call big futures. And both Brian and myself have been involved in these futurism and futures projects, typically at large organizations, where you're asked to basically predict the future or showcase a future vision for a certain product or project or idea. Both of us have done that kind of work. There are ways in which it can be done well and ways in which it can be done badly. But for the most part, we both have a kind of healthy disdain for that work because these futures that are created are often entirely devoid of interestingness. Mm-hmm. By being so far in the future and by being so polished, like they're often put together by creative departments. These big features are actually not very provocative by dint of not being meaningful or interesting or connected to today. And so we came up with this name, Little Futures, which is a kind of philosophy and a way of thinking designed around how do organizations do new things, but how do they do new things in a way which is actually tangible and meaningful to today? And so Little Futures, we have this phrase, arm's length futures. So like, you know, things that are within arm's reach. And we explore all kinds of things. I think when we first started it, we ran 6 newsletters just at the end of last year, and then it kind of went on pause when my son was born in December and life kind of got busy, and we were just relaunching season 2. It starts next week, I guess end of August, whenever this podcast is going out. And the philosophy for it is we want it to be useful to business leaders and creative thinkers and people working in kind of futures, like helping organizations do new things. But as well as being useful, we also want it to be provocative. And this is a cornerstone idea for me, which is related to what I was just talking about, voices. You know, there's a lot of newsletters and business writing in particular, which is designed to give you the conclusion to say, we've done some thinking, here's the situation, and here's what to think about it. And when done well, it's incredible, but often it's not done well and there's too much of it. And so instead, I would much rather focus Little Futures on this notion of kind of inquiry versus insight. It's like, we're not trying to give you the insight. We're trying to open up a space for inquiry to say, what if these ideas are interesting? What if these ideas are important? What would that mean for your business? What would that mean for your industry? And we're going to try and come at that from a different angle than hopefully most other people are doing. We're going to try and incorporate some of these different ideas and so on. That is obviously the marketing spin. You know, obviously behind the scenes, we're like, we don't really know what we're doing. We're just having fun sending emails. But I'm really enjoying this opportunity to kind of create a space for reflection and inquiry and provocation that I don't see enough of. And so, yeah, we're just starting back up soon.
I want to draw a really interesting parallel that you just described. So the last topic was just voice. And you were talking about how the problem with a lot of people when they start writing is that the voice is sterile and that it's so distant, so solutions oriented and so polished that it loses its meaning. And now we switch to talking about futures, little futures and big futures. And it's the same thing, right? These big futures, they're so idealized and they're so distant from the reality of a real conversation, a real way of living, that they're also not effective. So I thought that it was almost like we had the same conversation twice, but about 2 totally different topics. And that's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's an important idea for me generally is this idea of being honest and being true to your kind of sense of self-identity. And I think business, and I mean that in the very largest sense of the word, is a kind of force that drives people often to retreat from self-identity and personality. And I think that's a shame.
So for anyone that has not read it yet, check out Little Futures. It really is fantastic. Again, the last season is up now. And one of the things I would challenge you to do is open up one of the articles and scroll through it very quickly and try to think how Tom is going to put these topics together. Some of these posts cover like 5 or 6 very different things. And if you just look at them very quickly, you're going to be like, there's no way he's going to pull this off. But then you go back and you read this article and it's really just fantastic the way you kind of drive through, especially the article on Business Time. I love because it pulls in these very philosophical and psychological concepts of time and how we approach time and then really does ground it in a very business context. So again, please go check out Little Futures. Like Tom said, the next season is starting soon, but also go check back and check out season 1. So we've talked a lot about voice, particularly voice and writing. And again, your voice comes out so strongly in your writing, but I would imagine that that is something that you had to work on. So for someone who might be starting out producing content, whether that's written content or video content, do you have any recommendations for how they can develop their personal voice and how they can make sure that that voice comes through in all the work they produce?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a process of self-discovery and iteration for me. It's taken a long time, I think, to get here. I will say that I think the number one thing you can do is to read widely. And, you know, I think that there's this general lament in the technology sphere that blogs are dead. And it's just not true. There are more blogs than ever before. There is a thriving, interesting ecosystem of independent writers writing their own thing in their own weird and wonderful ways. And you just have to do the legwork to go seek it out. It's not as readily discoverable for you, right? It's not going to land in your inbox in the same way that Medium or Fast Company or Forbes will. And so if you spend your time reading the kind of mainstream outlets, you're going to be shaped by that way of thinking and that style. I'm going to try and emulate it. I have a blog post, it's actually one of my most popular blog posts of all time, called Small B Blogging, which is this philosophy at heart, which is if all you do is you read Forbes and Fast Company, you're going to try and emulate them with the writing that you do. And in fact, you might even want to write for Forbes or Fast Company. And my argument is that is a kind of way of blending in, which even if you reach a big audience through guest posting on something like Fast Company, that audience is going to be so far disconnected from who you are, and they're going to care so little about what you're writing about. You're just going to kind of get washed away in feeds. And so instead, I'd encourage you to start with reading more widely, right? Like get an RSS reader, subscribe to these weird and wonderful bloggers and email newsletters, and find people that have voice that you like. That's got to be step one, is to basically say, who am I trying to emulate, right? Who am I trying to be like? Who has voice that I find interesting? And that can be more difficult, right? It means that you have to read stuff where you're like, I don't really agree with this, or it's like a little bit meandering. It's obviously not as digestible as something like the mainstream stuff that you might read in your industry. But that's kind of the point, right? Like the point is that this stuff is a little bit more weird. It's a little bit more edgy. It might require a closer read to really get it. And if you spend your time there, then you're going to kind of like self-radicalize yourself a little bit to eventually be like, hey, I want to be like these people. I want to write this way. I want to have my own website. I want to, you know, do X, Y, and Z. And so for me, I've always had a love of like these alternative voices and reading pretty widely. And I think that has been the foundation that has allowed me to kind of explore my own tone and voice and perspective in my own writing. It's definitely a process. It's definitely an ongoing process. It's not a thing that you ever kind of solve, I don't think. And certainly different kinds of writing require different kinds of voice. I think reading has got to be the foundation.
Building on something Tom brought up earlier in his answer, of if you write for something like Inc. or Forbes as a guest writer, you might reach a lot more readers than with your personal blog. And in this era of Instagram followers and Facebook likes, it's very easy to get focused on the numbers, the size of your reach, how many people, how many eyeballs your content is going to hit. But to Tom's point, it's much better, whether we're talking content or product or a mailing list, a YouTube channel, a podcast like this, it's so much better to have 1,000 or 100 dedicated readers than it is to have 100,000 followers on Instagram that don't really care about what you have to say. And so being a little different, being more honest, developing a more personal voice, going against the grain a bit is a way that you can develop this kind of true fan base, these people that care what you have to say and are not just eyeballs on Instagram, that are not just Forbes readers, that are going to read Tom Critchlow's article and then go, I don't remember his name. It was a good article. Having control over your audience and having that closer relationship is much more powerful than just focusing on the size.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's one of the most insidious things about the internet is the ability to look at analytics and to see, to be able to quantify everything except the things that usually matter, which is like influence and attention, right? And when I write a post and I get an email from people who are like, wow, this is amazing. Like it really helped me think through X, Y, and Z, blah, blah, blah. And I look at my analytics. I'm like, oh, this post got 300 page views, right? There's nothing in the analytics that gives me that rich information around the connections and the people on the other end that are moved or are interested in this stuff. But there is another way to think about this, another mental model that I think is important to break, which is we've been trained through this lens of media to imagine that writing and producing content is a thing which is designed to build people who are inbound to our work.
True.
And that is true, and that does happen, and that is a thing that you can do, and I'm not rejecting that. But there is another way to think about it, which is creating content as an outbound vector to create meaningful connections with new people. And this can be as simple as writing a post and then sending it to somebody, right? And I still do this today when I'll be like, oh, I'm going to write this article about media, and then I'm going to send it to this person that is somebody I respect in the media industry and say, what do you think? Or, hey, I wrote this thing. It relates back to that thing you mentioned in the podcast. Or, hey, I wrote this thing and it extends the ideas that you reference X, Y, and Z. Like, people that are online are incredibly open to that stuff. To the point, even like I wrote a post a little while back, Seth Godin, I don't even know what number of years it is, 20 year mark, I guess, blogging. And redesigned his blog and put it on WordPress. And I wrote a blog post basically saying, congrats, Seth. And I sent it to him. And he replied, obviously, right? Like, people who are online are very approachable in this way. Yeah. But it's much harder to do that without a kind of a web presence and without creating something, right? And so I think that there's a way to think about content as a way to build audience and to build inbound and like have this flywheel effect, and all of that is true. But there is this other way to think about it, which is, especially when you're writing with voice, especially when you're writing something that you think is actually interesting to a certain set of people, is don't be afraid to actually send it to those people, right? And I'm certainly not talking about spamming, and I'm definitely not talking about cold emailing in the sense of like sales. I'm not talking about this in the context of like generating business. I'm just talking about making new connections to be able to be like, hey, I love your writing. You wrote about this. I wrote about it too. I would love to hear what you think. And you don't have to rely on them having to be inbound to your site to like quote unquote be part of your audience to create a meaningful dialogue and a meaningful connection.
On that point, a couple things that Tom just said that I want to highlight. First off is we focus so much in business on metrics, and a religious mantra of mine that I think I developed actually back at Google, but still is just something that I bring up all the time, is that any metric that becomes a target is no longer effective as neither a metric nor a target. And what that means is that anytime we pick a thing and we go, okay, I need to do 30 sales calls this month because last month I did 5 and that 5 sales calls got me 1 project. Now if I do 30, that'll get me 6 projects. If you focus just on the number of sales calls you're doing, you're going to degrade the quality. You're not going to be calling people who are the correct people to be calling. And so focusing on that number, focusing on the metrics, like Tom said, you know, the worst part of the internet is that we have metrics on everything. Really focusing in on these metrics and not on the outcomes can be a distraction. The other thing that we focus too much on in business is these outcomes, in that we don't do anything unless we feel like it's going to result in something for our business. And like Tom said, reaching out to Seth Godin with this article that he wrote wasn't about getting Seth to work with him. It was about establishing this relationship, being able to have a working relationship with someone like Seth. It's not about bringing the work in. It's about establishing yourself. It's about making these connections and seeing where those connections go. So focusing too much on the outcomes, focusing too much on what am I going to get out of this post that I write, out of this email that I send, it's the wrong way to go about it, especially if you're interested in doing this over the long term.
Yeah, I agree.
Tom, your work spans across so much. You have so much experience over the course of your career, and whether it's from where you started to where you are now, leading more kind of strategic related efforts. Would you have any specific media that you'd recommend our listeners if they're wanting to get started on a similar path to you, or are just curious to learn more about what it is that you do? Obviously, talking to people is kind of one of the best ways to learn about their career and their path. But in terms of just some easily accessible resources, is there anything that you would recommend?
I'll toot my own horn for a second. I'm currently writing a book for independent strategy consultants, which is designed to be a set of helpful resources that goes beyond the how-to stuff, but really explores the notion of identity and personal growth and so on. So you can find that on my website. The Strategic Independent is the working title of the book, and a bunch of those pieces are kind of free to read online. I'm still in the process of writing that. And I think that is hopefully a good place for people to look at, but also a good sense of what my own work looks like and so on. I'd also recommend a buddy of mine, Venkatesh Rao, who writes a blog, Ribbon Farm. He has an email newsletter called Art of Gig, which is specifically designed for independent workers, freelancers, consultants, and so on. And it's a little bit nerdy and theoretical at times, but you certainly can't fault his voice. He's carving his own path in the world and is one of the people that I look up to in terms of being weird and unique and being able to craft a lifestyle around this stuff. So those are some recommendations. I'd also, a little bit more broadly, one of my favorite email newsletters right now is called Fake Pixels by Tina He. And I would really recommend that for people who need a role model of something kind of pretty mainstream, right? So she works in venture capital, she's a VC. And the email that she writes is incredibly personal and human and full of inquiry rather than insight. And I think it's just a really great reference point for anyone who's like, can I do that? Am I in a boring industry? Am I supposed to conform? And I just think Fake Pixels, I mean, it's an incredibly well-written email, and it really just demonstrates, again, this idea of voice. And so for folks who are looking for a kind of inspiration around how do I write with personality? How do I write with feeling? And is it okay for me to be a little bit weird? I definitely recommend those newsletters.
Fantastic. Thank you for providing those. It's going to be the first thing I do after this podcast recording is go subscribe to all of them. So thank you for sharing.
So for everyone listening, we will have links in the liner notes to all of Tom's recommendations, as well as to Tom's personal site, to the site for Little Futures, which is his new newsletter, which again, I will recommend one final time, as well as his Brooklyn art collective, Fiercely Curious. We did not get to talk too much about that other than we mentioned it, but it's a super interesting project. If you're in art at all, you should definitely check it out. So we'll have links to all of those in the liner notes. Tom, thank you so much for being here today. Again, this was a really, really exciting episode for me, going back to that voice conversation of I've been reading your writing for a couple of years now, and having you on, you know, it felt as soon as we started talking, it was like, oh, I've talked to Tom before, even though I haven't. I've just read your work. So again, thank you so much for being here. I really had a great time today.
That's great. Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed the conversation, and thanks for the kind words. That is the encouragement that keeps me going. So appreciate it.
Great. Next week, longtime friend and fitness entrepreneur Dr. Anthony Balduzzi shares how an early tragedy oriented his life around helping others, the challenges that he's faced growing his businesses to 15 employees, as well as health tips for entrepreneurs. Until then, stay safe as you walk whichever of the hundreds of ways belongs to you.